the headlines this hour. Military cooperation between Iran and Russia and the upswing. The top Iranian general says the two countries will work together to eradicate terrorism in Syria. Hamas slams Israel's plans to double the settler population in the east of the occupied West Bank, saying the regime's expansionist projects will all end in failure. Also in the headlines, massive flooding and landslides caused a trail of destruction in India and in Nepal, leaving over 150 people dead and dozens missing in both countries. Thanks for joining us. Tehran and Moscow will continue their strategic cooperation to help establish sustainable security in the region. That is according to the chief of the general staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri. The top general has met with senior Russian military officials during an ongoing visit to Russia. He says the two sides discuss expanding cooperation and fighting international terrorism, which has been a top concern in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and the Caucasus region. Bagheri also talked about the future arms contracts between Tehran and Moscow. The Iranian general said that all these issues would be discussed in detail in a joint military commission scheduled in 3 months in Tehran. Resistance movement Hamas says the Israeli settlement projects are targeting the existence and the identity of the Palestinian population. Hamas says the Palestinians will continue their resistance until the occupying forces are expelled from every inch of the territory. It added that Israel's expansionist projects will all end in failure. Israel says construction is already underway to double the settler population in the east of the occupied West Bank. All these settlements are illegal under international law. Meanwhile, Palestinians are concerned about an Israeli bill which they say increases surveillance of their population under the pretext of curbing crime. The Palestinian Legal Defense Organization says the new legislation gives Israeli police the free hand to search any Palestinian home without a court warrant. The organization is worried that the bill could be used to terrorize people and increase tensions among Palestinians. Israel's parliament, the Knesset, is set to vote on the bill, but it is not yet clear whether the legislation will get a majority vote. Political commentator Mick Napier says that the proposed Israeli legislation will broaden powers and give the regime forces a green light to terrorize Palestinians in their own homes.
Israel considers itself to be a state for Jews. Jews who live in Palestine, yes, they were in the recent law, they were deemed to be the only ones to have certain democratic rights. But it's also a state for Jews who live in Scotland or Iran or America or Russia. And it's not a state in its own constitution, such as they have, for the Palestinian citizens of that state. Now that seems rather weird, but let it sink in. This state is not the state for the Palestinian citizens, and they are routinely described in Israeli academe as a demographic problem. They're described as a demographic problem at the top levels of Israeli politics. So they are people who are a problem for the state, and the state wants to be rid of them. Currently, they suffer from terrible segregation, much poorer outcomes in terms of education, sewage, water, housing compared to Jews. It's really stark and very, very clear.
It is time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Israeli regime has reportedly allocated a budget of some $1.5 billion to prepare its military for potential attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities. Israeli media say that the budget is slated to be approved by the regime's cabinet in November. The reports say the budget includes funds for various kinds of warplanes, spy drones, and arms needed for such attacks. Last week, Israel and its main backer, the U.S., renewed their military threats against the Islamic Republic over its nuclear activities. Iran maintains that its nuclear program is peaceful and subject to rigorous international inspections, while Israel allows no such checks and possesses hundreds of nuclear warheads. Tehran has also repeatedly warned Israel and its allies against any kind of military adventurism, saying that such a move will receive a crushing response. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist joining us from Kitchener. And we also have Keaton Mansfield, author and analyst, the Center for Political Innovation, who joins us from New York. I'd like to welcome you both. And Keaton Mansfield, let me first start with you. So you have Israel that has allocated this money with the aim of, possibly attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. So let me get this straight here. You're having this announcement being made publicly, while Israel has been accused by Iran to have attacked its nuclear facilities already, an incident that happened not on just one occasion, more than one occasion. So is Israel admitting to something that it's going to do in the future?
Well, it's hard to say for sure if Israel will carry out attacks against Iran. We certainly hope that it's an empty threat, but Israel has done things, and the U.S. have made similar acts of aggression in the past, be it assassinating Soleimani or putting Iran under sanctions. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so Israel is not announcing prematurely that it is going to attack Iran or going to do everything in its power to prohibit Iran from pursuing an advancement in the nuclear program and in nuclear testing, because that would seem very foolish from a tactical standpoint, the strategy of prematurely announcing that there's going to be an attack or that they're preparing to act aggressively towards Iran's nuclear program seems unlikely, but it could be just the opposite. It could be Israel waving around a gun, so to speak, and threatening that unless it gets what it wants, unless the UN continues to turn a blind eye to Israel's military and to the illegal and unjustified actions of Israel, that the Zionist state, with the backing of the U.S., with the backing of NATO, is prepared to attack Iran.
I mean, this is unprecedented, Robert Fantina, isn't it? We're talking about Israel, allocating this budget for potentially attacking Iran. And wait a minute, Israel is already attacking another sovereign nation, and that's Syria, repeatedly, maybe in the hundreds. And, of course, Iran to have accused Israel of attacking its nuclear facilities on more than one occasion, killing its nuclear scientists, etc. So my question, again, comes to the fact that is Israel admitting its guilt before it commits another act, which it's allocated money for it?
Israel doesn't see any guilt in what it does. Israel, like the United States, considers itself above the law, and the United States paves the way for it to do so. Israel has assassinated nuclear scientists in the past. As you mentioned, it's bombing Syria. It's a rogue nation. It's an apartheid nation, and it doesn't care to follow international rules. Unfortunately and tragically, the global community has allowed it to get away with its crimes against humanity and its violations of international law for decades. This needs to change. Right now, Israel may be issuing this threat and approving this money to force Tehran to negotiate, to renegotiate the JCPOA. The government of Iran says it is willing to re-enter the JCPOA when the other parties adhere to the agreement. It makes no sense for one party to adhere to the agreement and the others not to, and that is what is expected now. The United States violated international and U.S. law when Donald Trump, as president, withdrew from JCPOA. It had the approval of Congress. The entrance into the JCPOA had the approval of Congress. The departure did not. The United Nations had given a seal of approval to the agreement. So it is the United States and Israel that are continually violating international law. The government of Iran wants to protect its people from threats, and certainly the threats that the United States and Israel present are great and real. And the Iranian government has not only the right, but the responsibility to do what's necessary to protect its people.
Putting aside the fact, Keith Mansfield, I'm not a technician, but I'm assuming that when you attack a nuclear facility, that there's going to be consequences that could be very fatal, you know, in terms of anything that comes out of that in the form of contamination. So putting that aside, and putting aside the fact that Israel does have an active nuclear program, it's got nuclear warheads, does the U.S. military aid, which is in the billions, I think $3.7 billion a year, be part of this $1.5 billion, or for the $1.5 billion to be part of that U.S. military aid, which would then mean that the U.S. is also part of this potential attack on Iran if Israel wanted to?
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. Israel would be nothing without the backing of the U.S., without the backing of entities controlled and influenced by the U.S. I mean, the U.S. has proposed billions of dollars to go to the Iron Dome missile program. The U.S. has sent billions of dollars in weaponry in the past, as well as training countless IDF soldiers, and in turn, IDF soldiers training New York police officers. And so should Israel enter into a hot conflict with Iran, should the stalemate or the kind of the cold aggression between the two countries turn hot, I feel certain that the U.S. would intervene. The U.S. would step in on the side of Israel, would back the Israeli aggression, which in turn would draw Syria into the fray, and potentially Afghanistan, Russia, China. I mean, the possibilities are endless if the U.S. were to support a war or further attacks against Iran. And Iran would have no option but to defend itself. We've seen time and time again that the U.S., if it's given an inch, it will take a mile. And so Iran will be forced to stand strong against U.S. aggression, the kind of attempting to negotiate and be friendly with the U.S. and with U.S. policy has proven unsuccessful for the past 8 years. And I think that the Iranian government is realizing, is well aware, that the U.S. is not here to play fair. The U.S. and Israel is not going to follow international law or ensure that proper procedure is followed when it comes to UN oversight for nuclear testing and different facilities. And so that's kind of the realization we're at, that this could spark a very deadly conflict or have very deadly results and be a disaster for the Middle East.
Thank you for that. Keaton Mansfield, author and analyst at the Center for Political Innovation. Thank you, Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kishner. Deadly day in the Syrian capital. A twin bomb explosion has ripped through an army bus in Damascus, leaving 14 personnel dead and several others injured. The bombs went off as the bus was crossing under a bridge during the morning rush hour. A third bomb was defused. There had been no immediate claim of responsibility. Iran and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah condemned the deadly incident. Tehran said blind and cowardly acts of terrorism are doomed to fail and will not affect the steadfastness of the Syrian people to free their country from terrorists. Syria has experienced a number of gun and bomb attacks, especially after the army took over the last militant bastion near the capital in 2018. Political analyst Marcus Papadopoulos says that a coordinated attack in Syria shows that terror groups, including Daesh, are receiving training from Western sources.
My analysis of the attacks in Damascus shows that they were very well coordinated, very well planned, and they were brutally executed, which demonstrates that some very influential players in the world have been training these terrorist cells. So even though the advances of the Syrian army, the liberation of most of Syrian soil, cannot be rolled back now by the terrorist groups and their patrons, such as America, Britain, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, nonetheless, this is a way of the terrorists and their supporters inflicting losses on Syria. It is a way of keeping the fight going. It is a way of warning the Syrian people that they are not entirely safe in their towns and cities and villages throughout Syria. So I believe this attack is more of a psychological attack on the Syrian people.
10 days after Iraq's parliamentary elections, the controversy over the results is still nowhere near a resolution. Shia political factions now say that they will not participate in any negotiations over a future government as long as the issue remains unsettled. The groups are calling on the Election Commission to provide legal evidence before the announcement of the final outcome, either a new election or a manual recount of the ballots. That's what these factions are asking for. The Commission says that a recount is already in progress, but that it will take place only in areas where there have been irregularities. The initial tally has put the bloc of influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in the lead with over 70 of the nearly 330 seats in Parliament. The federal court will have to certify the final results. Massive flooding and landslides have left a trail of devastation in India and in Nepal. Over 150 are dead and dozens are missing in both countries. The floods, triggered by incessant rains, have inundated acres of farmlands and residential areas in two Indian states, Uttarakhand in the north and Kerala in the south. Rainfall has exceeded 400 millimeters, with Indian Army personnel conducting search and rescue operations in some regions. Officials in Uttarakhand have said locals are faced with a series of problems, as crops have been destroyed and roads are waterlogged. In neighboring Nepal, 77 fatalities have been recorded. Dozens more remain unaccounted for. Heavy to very heavy rainfall is forecast for the coming days. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
To be honest, I was thinking about what the director said today. It was a challenge. He asked me to name one thing in the studio that is not made of any mineral source, such as oil or metals. Believe me, nothing came to mind. You're right there. One of today's topics is mines and mineral products in Iran. Iranians are lucky to live in a land with really rich mines. They have access to most mineral rocks, actually. Iran is the world's 17th largest country. It covers 1% of all landmass on the planet. Iranian soil happens to be located on Earth's metallurgical belt. That is a belt rich in minerals, all of which the modern world has great need for. Copper, gold, iron, lead, and zinc are but small examples. Even so, there's been minimal investment in exploration in Iran, and so this country is not aware of its full potential. For example, Iran is estimated to possess 7% of the world's resources, but in 2015, of $9 billion worth of exploration, Iran's share was just $25 million. That's just 0.3%. Therefore, investment in this sector would be highly profitable to foreign companies. Iranians themselves haven't sat back idly either. They've invested extensively in the mine sector. For a close-up view of what Iranians have done in this regard, we set out for an industrial complex to watch their production process from A to Z. And to begin with, what could be better than copper? Copper has the best electrical conductivity of all metals except for silver. And the world of telecommunications is based upon a copper infrastructure. Also, there's plenty of copper to be found here in the studio.
From your everyday clothes to the plate of your food, from the car you drive to the screen on which you are watching this program, everything you are in one way or another in contact within your everyday life has something to do with minerals. Mines have in fact shaped expansion of human civilization. Meanwhile, countries richer in mineral resources and more technologically developed to extract minerals from deposits are apt to see more progress. Hearing the name of Iran in economic communities would generally remind one of oil and gas. It is true that the country sits atop at least 10% of the world's proven crude oil and nearly 18% of gas reserves. However, there might be relatively very few who know that the same Iran is in possession of 7% of the mineral deposits worldwide as well. Mr. Ali Khani is an advisor to Mines and Metals Development Investment Company. He explains more. Copper is one of the most profitable minerals in Iran that is widely used in many countries. Given its preferred conductivity, copper is used in nearly all categories of electrical engines and wiring. It is also used for construction of ships and pipes to prevent calcium and lime buildup. Copper and its alloys are natural antimicrobial materials and are used in many medicinal preparations, among other uses. This is Ahmad Morad Alizadeh. He used to manage National Iranian Copper Industries Company. This company owns three big mines in two provinces of Kerman and East Azerbaijan. It is the third most profitable company in Iran's stock exchange market. After 1.5 hours' drive from central Kerman, we arrived in Sarcheshme, where these huge holes were once big mountains, having been dug out over time. One of Iran's biggest copper mines is located in Sarcheshme, 159 kilometers south of the southern city of Kerman. Sarcheshme is considered to hold the 15th biggest copper deposits worldwide. By itself, Kerman province is viewed as one of the richest regions in Iran for its mineral reserves.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show so far and found it educational. Our tour of Sarcheshme city and its grand factory is not over yet, but I'd best give you this information right here, right now. You may not see Iran listed among the world's top 10 richest countries in copper, but Iran enjoys special privileges in this domain. First of all, Iranian copper is really highly concentrated. Secondly, Iran has mines that are either untouched or not yet expanded. Given copper is expensive in world markets and Iran offers attractive conditions to investors, Iranian mines would be the best investment option.
After exploration is done, they will blast the mine to start excavation. workers will transfer the rich soil to the factory. Here, in these machines, the soil will be crushed until it is broken down to 80 micron grains. Then, using flotation method, waste is separated. These scary furnaces make copper anodes. Now, pure copper is almost in the reach. Anodes are then moved to refineries, and using electrolysis method, they'll be transformed into cathode, which is 99.99% pure copper. Iran's revenues from the sale of copper have dwindled in recent years due to the weak demand from top copper consumer China, thanks to an economic slowdown in the country. Although Trump's biting sanctions are back on track, this company is planning to produce 540,000 tons of copper in the near future. The country is planning to lure foreign investors into the sector, however. Investment data shows that a sizable majority of investments offered by foreign financiers in Iran since January 2016 that Tehran's Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, was implemented were aimed at capitalizing projects in the mining sector. Development of the sector would not only lead to faster economic growth in Iran, but would also tackle unemployment. In order to facilitate the arrival of foreign investors into the country and addressing their concerns, the Organization for Investment, Economic and Technical Assistance of Iran, an affiliate to the Ministry of Economy, has been established to play an instrumental role in this regard. For more information on the ins and outs of investing in Iran, check www.investiniran.ir. Copper is but one of Iran's mineral industries. Another Iranian produce is iron, plenty of which is to be found on this land. Just one example is the iron mine of Golgohar city, where over 1 billion and 250 million tons of iron ore lie dormant. This mine is in southern Iran and has a long way to go before exhaustion. Eastern Iran also has its riches. There lies the Sangon mine, with over 850 million tons of iron ore waiting to be extracted. We'll visit these mines in future shows. Be you rich or poor, busy exploring new mines or new galaxies, you can do nothing without hydrocarbons, vitamins, and proteins. To provide food for 7 billion people is no easy task. Given such vast population, human life today would be not possible without the food industry or food factories. Iran has 82 million people, a number not easy to feed. The Iranian food industry is really vast, and it produces and exports nearly every type of halal food popular in the Middle East. If you, like me, had to waste 2 hours a day in the traffic, you wouldn't find 2 hours time for cooking a meal. So do forgive me for opting for ready meals. There are plenty of Iranian factories producing the ready meals that are so popular in today's world. But there are also those factories producing traditional Iranian food packaged to go with modern methods. Quality standards really matter with these products because such food may go unconsumed for days and weeks, in which time they must not lose quality or taste. On the other hand, they must not produce poisons harmful to the buyer. I've said plenty, but only to prepare you for a report by my dear friend Amir Mehdi Kazimi.
It is an inseparable part of every friendly gathering and birthday party in Iran, a cold hors d'oeuvre which many Iranians prefer as a main course. For decades, the old Russian potato salad, also known as Olivier salad in Iran, has gathered families and friends around one table. However, in the mid-90s, this tasty darling of the Iranians suddenly vanished from restaurants and sandwich shops across the country, after sales were banned by authorities due to hygiene concerns. But soon after, two close friends came up with a brilliant idea and that was to get a legal license for the mass production of Olivier salad with all the health certificates.
Entrepreneurs say that ideas belong to those who execute them, and this is a good example of how combining the simplest materials along with proper planning could turn into a booming business, targeting a market with more than 80 million potential consumers.
Nomino headquarters and main production facility is near Isfahan City. It is where the finest ingredients like potatoes, chicken, carrots, and mayonnaise are combined to prepare the most highly demanded Olivier salad in the entire country. The products are various, ranging from chicken and bologna salad to club sandwiches, rolls, and sausages. Nearly all machineries here are customized for the mass production of Russian potato salad and other cold meals. Observing the strictest health and food safety standards becomes even more difficult when it comes to mass producing foods which are made with fresh ingredients and served cold on the platter. And that seems to be the biggest challenge for the quality control department, whose task is to make sure that everything from flavor to hygiene goes perfectly well from point A to the end user. Iranians are a nation with a big appetite. Like other parts of the world, people have their preferences when it comes to food. Consumers could become very picky in a country with endless flavor choices. Nomino produces all the ingredients used in the manufacturing process. The company even supervises the cultivation process of potatoes and carrots to make sure that they are exactly what is needed by the factory. Experts say that Iran is standing at a very good position when it comes to the quantity, the quality, and diversity of both agricultural and dairy products. And this has created a lucrative market for both investors and entrepreneurs. Today, Iranian consumers are faced with new packagings, new brands, new products, and higher standards every day. And those who once considered themselves as small business owners are now introducing themselves as food giants who are looking for markets outside the borders of the country. The two partners who once started from scratch now recruit a considerable number of people in their factories across the country. They also export food products to countries like the UAE, Oman, Qatar, Iraq, Afghanistan, Armenia, and Georgia, and there are hopes to create more demand in those markets. Today, Nomino is a familiar name across Iran. The two friends who once joined hands and followed their dream to turn a tiny business into a big one created one of the most famous success stories among Iranian entrepreneurs. Amir Mehdi Kazemi for Bazaar.
Thank you, Amir Mehdi, for the report on Nomino. This week, I'll give you statistics on goods with the highest import rates into Iran. Iranian customs statistics show field corn and rice are at the top of the list, going by the revenues they generate in dollars. Some other agricultural products popular with Iranian importers are beans, soybean meal, barley, and sunflower seeds. These products are used to producing oil, cattle feed, and so forth. But as Iran is also being producer of automobiles in the world, a commodity it much demands is automobile spare parts, which are assembled in its factories. Another popular commodity in Iran is dietary supplements. These are bought mostly by pharmaceutical or factories and drug importers. You may find this information useful as producers or salespersons of these products, because it will help you choose your market more carefully. By the way, and I want to tell you about Iran's drug production on this episode of Bazaar. Iran has been under heavy sanctions, yes, but the country's drug production capacity is really high. Different factories with an impressively high production capacity are at work. Some make up to 200 types of medicine, some of which are produced under foreign licenses in Iran. Apart from regular medicines such as antibiotics and over-the-counter painkillers, Iran has managed to enter the realm of complex medicine, such as radiopharmaceuticals and biologic drugs for special illnesses. To familiarize you with these realms, we paid a visit to Osfer Company.
We're talking an area on Tehran's outskirts, an area packed with factories, automobile factories, and pharmaceutical, petrochemical, and clothes factories, among others. It's an area to the west of Tehran, close to Alborz province. Our intended factory is also on a road to Alborz province, the Osfer Pharmaceutical Factory, with a varied range of drugs to produce. Osfer is a public stock company. It was established as early as 1966, but it has managed to adapt to new research and findings. For example, a medicine this company is proud to have produced in Iran is Deferasirox. Its non-generic name is Osvarov, and what it does is it reduces blood iron levels for patients in need of long blood transfusions, such as patients suffering from thalassemia or chronic low blood counts. It makes medicine to control blood pressure and to cure migraine, insomnia and depression, nephrology, diabetes and blood lipids. It also makes various vitamins. A common ailment among Iranians is high blood pressure due to their high levels of salt consumption and sedentary lifestyles. A third of Iranians over 30 suffer from this. At least 100,000 people allegedly die from high blood pressure each year. The health ministry has done a lot to control this, but 40% of people with high blood pressure don't even know they have it. But what has Osfer done for those suffering from it? You are all aware not everyone exercises to need just dietary supplements. Many an ailment can be prevented with a little exercise, but too many people are too busy for that. There are those illnesses that have nothing to do with exercise, however, but are hereditary. For those, plenty of medicine is needed. But drug consumption is generally high in Iran, such that Iran ranks 20 among countries of the world, with each Iranian annually consuming four times as much medicine as the world standard. Iran, with its 80 million population, consumes as much medicine as China, with its population of 1.3 billion. But does this mean Iranians get ill more often? No, actually. It's just that their use of drugs is unregulated. And to meet their demand, Iran has plenty of pharmaceutical factories active in research and expansion and quality production. They even export some of their items manufactured. Going by the statistics of Iran's Food and Drug Administration, about 95% of drugs required domestically are produced in Iran. In the early days of the Islamic Revolution, Iran produced only about 500 drugs. But now, this country's producing 3,000 drugs in 4,000 pharmaceutical variations. Iran has at present 15 pharmaceutical faculties, which train scores of pharmacists and researchers each year. Also, over 100 drug distributing companies are active in Iran today. In spite of the glittering statistics, however, there are those who say some 40% of the raw material for these drugs are imported from mainly India. But the Ministry of Health counts these drugs as part of the same 95% domestic produce. And there are the many who believe it's altogether irrelevant where the raw material comes from, because the art of pharmacology is to know how to mix those raw materials. Also, to domestically produce all the raw material needed may not even be cost efficient. The biggest obstacle to the Iranian industry, such as the pharmaceutical industries, is cruel U.S. sanctions. U.S. authorities have time and again stressed that Iran's pharmaceutical sector is exempt from sanctions. But imposing sanctions on the finance and money transfer sector is practically as good as boycotting the pharmaceutical sector. This hypocritical act by both Democrat and Republican U.S. officials has caused hundreds of patients to die. Patients whose medicine Iran has not yet managed to make domestic, that is, to adapt as native to Iran. In spite of all this pressure, Iranian companies have managed even to export their produce. These exports have also been touched by US sanctions, however. This is while Iran's domestic drug market is worth $4.5 billion, and it is said Iranian-produced drugs are twice the country's domestic need. In other words, Iran could easily satisfy regional countries' pharmaceutical needs, if only US sanctions could have been omitted from the equation. This company has enjoyed many achievements in Iran, but even on an international scale, it has acquired two licenses for innovation, health and safety, and quality from the German ICS Group. Modern pharmaceutical methods are a continuation of that path, but with greater precision and the use of chemistry. But with yet greater scientific advancement, today medicine is made with proteins derived from living cells cultured in the lab. This is called biopharmacology. You may have heard the names of some of these biopharmaceuticals, such as hormones like insulin or growth hormones, blood factor vaccines for anemia stemming from hepatitis B, and several other names to cure tough-to-treat illnesses. These drugs have been effective in curing common forms of cancer, such as breast cancer, in chemotherapy, in curing several arthritis of the joints, chronic kidney failure, and several other ailments. Knowledge-based companies in Iran have managed to make over 20 base or blueprint medicines, and Iran is a forerunner in biopharmaceuticals. Such medicines are about 146 worldwide, and Iran aims to bring its figures up to 40 soon. These drugs will be much cheaper than their foreign equivalents. Iran these days has managed to export its drugs to some 17 countries, and given its biopharmaceutical know-how, it has succeeded in greatly alleviating its patients' pain. A prominent company in this field is Synergen. Amir Mehdi Kazemi, a dear friend, visited this company to learn about the range of its products. Don't miss this report, because you're in for a surprise.
Less than three decades ago, a big idea came to the minds of a group of Iranian biotechnologists. The aim was to help cure patients with chronic diseases in Iran and across the world. That was a turning point for the pharmaceutical industry of Iran. A few years later, the same group of scientists, who were now joined by a considerable number of their colleagues, decided to establish a center for the production of biopharmaceuticals, a company which today takes its steps on the edge of science. People here believe that their ambition is beyond imagination. In the year 2000, Synergen took the first steps towards producing recombinant proteins and monoclonal antibodies aimed at manufacturing biopharmaceuticals. Today, a diverse range of biomedicines are produced at this facility near Karaj City, about 50 kilometers west of the capital, Tehran.
The novel idea of making such a company came about 25 years ago with the novel idea of a group of young scientists. Actually, we manufacture a huge basket of different products in the field of biosimilars. We are a market leader.
We take a look into the most advanced biopharmaceutical facility in the Middle East, a maze of high-tech clean rooms and laboratories where some of the world's latest technologies are being used. Recombinant DNA technology is a technique that introduces the gene of interest in a host, which in this case is Chinese hamster ovary or bacterial cells. It all starts from the cell culture department, where recombinant cells are fed and grown in what is known as a culture media to produce the protein of interest and the biopharmaceutical used for treatment of a particular disease. The medicine is then extracted from a complex mixture and purified using chromatography steps and purification techniques. Thousands of square meters of clean room space.
dozens of bioreactor containers and elite staff wearing special suits, an environment rarely seen anywhere else in the Middle East. Currently, the team of experts at the company take their steps shoulder to shoulder with their counterparts in the U.S. and Europe, observing international quality and state-of-the-art good manufacturing practices, or GMP standards, has enabled the company to supply a part of the world markets with medicines that offer the same quality of their reference products with competitive prices.
Actually, in this department, we control or reject the quality of the product, even the packaging material or anything that comes and into the production area and quality control area, based on the guidelines and regulation in the world class. And that's how we get the GMP certificate from the top regulatory bodies.
The manufacturing of sophisticated medicines for the treatment of incurable diseases such as multiple sclerosis and cancer, as well as other maladies like osteoporosis, anemia, and renal failure, are no longer under the monopoly of pharmaceutical giants in the West. In fact, new powerful players are emerging with new ambitions that include sharing their sciences with others and helping to cure patients in less prosperous societies across the world next to their commercial objectives.
Many thanks once again. Don't forget to leave your comments on our social pages, as your opinions will help us improve. Till next week, when we'll introduce you to other Iranian products, goodbye and God be with you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the book The Inner Voice, Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi aptly explains the need for a man to understand his purpose in life and to be able to ponder over some of the important aspects of our journey in reaching nearness to Allah. Today, we will read to you an excerpt of this book. Stay with us. Thankfulness to Allah. And be thankful to me, and do not be ungrateful. Quran chapter 2, verse 152. Thankfulness to God is one of the highest virtues which a man could aspire for. It is easy to be thankful when one has got an easy life. a prospering business, a respectful job, and a happy family. It is a different story when things are not going as desired. Most of us, in such situations, remain obsessed with sorrow, forgetting countless bounties of God which we are bestowed with even at the time of that tragedy. Perhaps it is this tendency which is mentioned in the Quran in these words, "And few among my servants are grateful." It is even more difficult to be grateful in such heartbreaking situations which a man of God has to face in his struggle to lead his people on the right path, like the condition which our Holy Prophet Muhammad had to contend with. He faced abuse of the community, wrath of big tribal heads. Children used to throw stones on him. Women scattered thorny bushes in his path, and he remained cheerful and thankful to God. When a man asked him, why did he pray whole nights and fasted almost continuously when he had so much work to do every day, the Prophet simply asked, should I not be a thankful servant to Allah? Many examples can be found of men of God bearing the burdens of almost inevitable persecutions with great patience. Muhammad faced them with cheerfulness and thankfulness. The difference between two attitudes is clear enough. Not only this, his closest people also thought of these hardships as a sign of the grace of God. Had not God chosen them to bear such heavy burden in his cause? Was it not a sign of his pleasure with them? It was this thought which made them face cheerfully all this kind of persecutions inflicted by the enemies of God. It was this feeling which made Hazrat Ali not only patient, but thankful when he was asked by the Holy Prophet to sleep in the Prophet's bed, so that the Prophet could leave Mecca while his would-be killers who ringed his house thought that he was sleeping in his bed. His only question was, will your life be saved if I sleep in your bed? When assured that it was the promise of God, he prostrated to God, thanking him that he made his, that is Ali's life, a ransom for the life of the Holy Prophet. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was an excerpt from the book Inner Voice by Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi. Our website is parstoday.com. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.